Hi, Steve Artimer here, and welcome to the New Life Live podcast. We hope to provide help and hope in your life through God's Word, counselors, and psychologists as we answer questions from listeners who call with the challenges of life. Let's go to today's episode.
Hello, everyone. I'm so glad that you decided to join us today. And we're going to hear from Chris Williams and Dr. Jackie Mack Harris as we take your calls at 1-800-229-3000. I would love to know what is on your mind, Chris.
Okay, here's what's on my mind. In a few days, you know, come up in a couple weeks, I will have my first teenager.
Okay? Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know. It's
good time to hit.
It's stressing me out, okay? There's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of variables in this world, a lot of dangers. There's technology. There's phones. There's all of this stuff. There's also my great fears. And man, does parenting bring out my great fears. And my great fears get in the way of great connection. And here's what happens is I'll have a fear about my son and girls, you know, and then I'll write a really bad story about his present and future based on, and the central figure of the story is fear. Now, what this does then it is it impacts my communication and my relationship with him, because I'm not communicating from a place of true curiosity or connection. Fear on the backside of that is always going to look to control. And so my ultimate desire with my sons is that we would have open communication in as much as possible. You know, I mean, in an ideal world, they would tell me anything at any point in time. I know that that's ideal, but I want to be moving in that direction. But one of the things I need to practice that Paul was really inviting us all into, and especially those Philippians, was be anxious for nothing. I'm really working and working hard, and I need God's help on non-anxious parenting. So that the contagion of my fears isn't infecting my children.
I'm so glad you said that. When we presented in Japan, we presented our workshops called the Single Story Reset Workshop. And basically, we're resetting that single story that fearful parent overlaid over your life.
Yeah.
And so whether it was the fearful parent or something in society or in your religion, people begin to live a life according to some story someone else is telling for them.
Yeah.
And it often doesn't fit. And that's when we hear things about imposter syndrome or people are struggling in their life and they're so miserable, but and they think they're doing everything right. They're doing all the things they were told they were supposed to do.
Yeah.
But it doesn't actually fit them. It's not actually their journey because they weren't allowed to be curious about what they wanted to be. All of that was controlled for them. Someone else decided, I need you to be a good Christian man, and that means you're going to do these things.
Yeah.
And that doesn't give them the opportunity to explore who it is God's creating them to be.
And to work that out in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think too, Chris, what you're talking about is not an age limit. Mm-hmm. I think as parents of adult kids, we can have that fear looking to control, and it keeps us from being curious about their lives.
Yes.
And to do the research, where is the fear coming from? Yeah. What if the worst possible thing happens? Then what?
It's so life limiting. And relationship limiting.
Yes, because really, when we get into the non-anxious presence, we can open our ears. Mm-hmm. We can open the communication. We can invite transparency and vulnerability. Yeah. But when we come in with fear and control, we're going to shut it all down.
Right, and then we're limiting all that they can grow into.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah. And that scripture, be anxious for nothing, but instead, with thanksgiving, present your request to God.
Yes.
Who can hear? And it will cause us to pause and not to go into that control mode, which is really kind of surprising. It's obvious. Fear does impact our connection. It causes us to control, which kills connection. We hope to connect with you right after this.
To find out more information about New Life or to order any of the resources mentioned on today's program, call 1-800-NEW-LIFE. Now back to New Life Live.
I'm Steve Artimer with a New Life Moment.
One day, a Sunday school teacher was discussing the Ten Commandments with a class of 5- and 6-year-olds. And after explaining to the children what honoring their fathers and mothers meant and exploring a few practical ways the kids could do that, she decided to raise another related question. Children, asked the teacher, is there a commandment in Scripture that teaches us how to treat our brothers and sisters? A little boy in the front row instantly raised his hand. Yes, Michael, said the pleased teacher. What does God command us about how to treat our brothers and sisters? Without missing a beat, the little boy earnestly answered, Thou shalt not kill. The funny little guy touches on some truth. Relationships are tough, aren't they? For some practical help with your challenging relationships, sibling, parental, at the job or other, visit newlife.com. I'm Steve Arterburn, and thanks for listening to this New Life Moment.
You know, it's so great to hear Steve's insight. And Chris, at the break, you just said something before we went back to air about relationships and intimacy. Can you recall that intimacy quote that you just
said?
Yeah,
it's a great dilemma of intimacy, is that we're all craving it, and yet we have such a difficult time with it, because intimacy's job is to expose. And true intimacy doesn't discriminate on what it exposes. It exposes everything. And that's why it's like, I was fine until I got married. You know, and so couples do this all the time. They blame the other person. You know, my life was great until I met you. No, my denial was active until our relationship exposed things inside of me that I need to work on.
Yeah, I love that. And even what Steve just said about that brother, thou shalt not kill, that's a really good, really good commandment to follow in relationships. And we kill each other in lots of different ways, but we can help you with that along the way. You know, one of the things that we started doing is we realized that we have so many people that listen on our podcast. They listen in other times other than live radio. And so we want to hear from you. We want to hear your questions. And we set up a process that you can ask a question at another time, and we will talk about it here on the show. And so if you go to newlife.com/radio, there are instructions there, and it's a great way for us to hear from you. Matter of fact, we're going to hear a voicemail from Mary, and right now, I think.
Hello, this is Mary from Maryland, and I have a question. I have been feeling super guilty because my son has a mental illness, and he has been taking the meds for about a year. He was supposed to start working, and I feel like I didn't really encourage him as much because he wanted me to buy him a moped, and I hesitated to, he didn't say to buy him a moped. He said he would start working and save for one. So I just thought to myself I would tell him that I would pay for half of it once he started saving, but I didn't tell him. And so he decided to run away from the group home where he was staying and where they were holding him accountable to take the meds. He ran away to New York City, and he's homeless out there. I feel so guilty because I just think if I would have gotten him the moped, he wouldn't have gone. And now it's going to be really hard to get him back to Maryland where I live. So I just wanted to know if you thought the guilt that I'm feeling is really a false guilt or true guilt, because I was helping him while he was in the group home. He wasn't paying for rent or clothes, food he had to buy with the money that I gave him and the money he got for groceries. I've been feeling a horrible, deep feeling of guilt and depression after he left. And I just wonder if it was true guilt or if it is false guilt.
That is so heartbreaking. So heartbreaking. And, you know, we hear stories like Mary's a lot, where you have someone who is in the family has mental illness, you do everything that you can to care for them. How can we help her with this guilt?
Well, I think it starts here that, let me just say it out loud, it's false guilt, 100%, you know? Mm-hmm. But with that, I think it's important to understand what's happening beneath the surface, is that her son is struggling with this really serious mental illness, this serious condition. And that she's doing everything she can to help him. But I talk about this often in the conditions that other people are in, whether it be an addiction, a mental illness, it could be an abusive relationship. We have to understand our own powerlessness against what is happening inside of them. But when there is suffering, there's a mechanism inside of us that can't accept the fact that we can't do anything about it. And so it seeks to control. So like if a moped would help him make a good decision and take his meds, like we just follow that line of thinking, and it doesn't make sense. That's not how this works. It's not how mental illness works. But even if he said, if I got the moped, I would take my meds, it's like, that's also ridiculous. You know, that's not, again, it's not how it works. But the guilt then says, I want to take control of this. I want to have control in this situation. And so the control factor is, if I would have given, the story that control makes up is that if I would have given him the moped, it would have helped him out. He would have stayed and he would have done his job, gotten this job, and he wouldn't be homeless in New York City. Because I can't handle, my insides can't handle the fact that I truly couldn't do anything about the fact that he's homeless in New York City.
Yeah. And that he made choices that were his own. I think it was interesting that Mary wanted to offer to help him. He hadn't asked. He didn't ask her to buy him a moped. He didn't ask her to go half. So she kind of created this whole scenario on her own that she now feels guilty for, as though he said, Mom, hey, I'm struggling. Can you help me get a moped? And she said, no, I can't. And then he took off and went to New York. That
fine,
did
I'm
not happen.
Taking, yeah, fine. And, I'm not taking my meds and I'm going to go be homeless in New York City.
Right. So that's not the story that's happened. The story that's happened is he struggles and he's now gone to New York. And her question is the false guilt. Yeah, it's false guilt. And maybe it's time for Mary to get some counseling of her own and maybe join a support group, a life recovery group, or Al-Anon or something, so that she can start to focus on her, which I know has got to be incredibly hard, having her child living on the streets in New York. It's got to be really hard to focus on herself, but that's what she has control of.
And I want to mention a resource. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI is what it's called, does a lot of family support groups for family members of those struggling with mental illness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm going to send Mary a copy of Understanding and Loving a Person with Depression, even though we don't know exactly what his diagnosis is. We know that that's probably part of it. You know, the false guilt versus real guilt, the basic definition is if you do something wrong, you're guilty, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that pretty much it? But I love what you just said, Jackie, about you, the storyline that Mary has in her head is that I refused him something and therefore he did this.
Right.
And we're not that powerful. I mean, we will take on a lot of responsibility for things that we are not that powerful. Because if we were, I think there'd be a different story, that he would have gotten a job and he would have been, you know, that's where we live a lot of times.
Yeah.
And Chris, what do you think? I can see you thinking about that.
No, yeah, I completely agree.
Right.
Yeah.
As you said, we're powerless. Not only are we not that power, we have no power to control another person. It's the fantasy that you're living in that's causing some grief, to not be like, you're stuck in the grief. You're not allowing yourself to be in the process of healing for yourself and mourning the fact that your son has mental illness.
Well, and that's where that false guilt oftentimes come in other grief processes as well, you know. So, you know, so-and-so passed away, so-and-so overdosed, or so-and-so, I wish I would have just fill in the blank,
you know.
Yeah. And so, or if I would have. Mm-hmm. And so when we insert ourselves in situations that, you know, are circumstances beyond our control, again, it's an attempt to control the uncontrollable because we can't deal with the suffering that that the situation presents us.
Yeah.
And I say that with deep
compassion.
And
I would encourage Mary to do what we've suggested with group and with even a counselor, but also, Chris, what you just said, it's dealing with the feelings that you have. It could be, Mary, that you contact the New York police and let them know that he's missing, you know, can do that, but it's just, you know, moving through those processes and grieving what you wished could have been true. And that's, you know, we all have that journey to take.
And even though he struggles with mental illness, stay curious. Mm-hmm. So often we think we're helping people, but we're only bringing our story to the conversation. We're not even interested in what's going on inside of them. We're not even interested in what they're afraid of or what has hurt them or what they're trying to accomplish, what they're fantasizing about or dreaming about. We just come in with our solution because what they're doing is hurting us. So stay curious.
Yeah, I love that. We'll be praying for you too, Mary. We're going to go to the calls, and we're going to listen to what Amy has to say. She's calling us from Daytona, Florida, listens on Sirius XM. Hello, Amy. How can we help you today?
Hi, I was calling just looking for some advice how to handle a situation. We've recently had to move my 92-year-old mother into a residential group home where she has to share a room, and she had previously been living independently, and she's not taking the move very well. She's depressed. She often says that she wishes she could just go to sleep and God wouldn't wake her up. And I don't know how to respond when she says that, because honestly, I look at her situation and just how hard life is. She's wheelchair bound. I would feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to find the words. I'm just looking for some advice on how to deal with this and how to help her grieve this new stage of life.
I would just what you just said makes so much sense to me. I would feel the same way. Like, I imagine that if I were in her shoes, mm-hmm. having been independent, living on my own, and now I'm sharing a room with someone in a boarding care and in someone else's house, I'm losing so much control. I'm in a wheelchair. And still, even though I could maybe say I would probably feel the same way, while it's so hard, you're so strong, you know, just being present with her and validating what she's feeling, but also celebrating that she did wake up, celebrating that she's not making choices to harm herself, because we don't necessarily have to act off of what we feel. Our emotions mm-hmm. matter. It's important. And as I was saying before about the other call, be curious. Ask her questions. What has this been like for her? Was there a period leading up to her going into the group home of her having a say in it? Did she mm-hmm. get to help choose it? Is anyone concerned about how she wanted her home dealt with before she moved there? There's just a lot of times when someone is under our care, we're moving forward, hopefully in their best interest or what we believe to be their best interest, but without them being informed or without allowing them to inform the process. And so I would just encourage you to remain curious, can validate her experience and that this is hard and that it's okay for her to be sad and to grieve that she's not in her home anymore, because you're not going to undo it. I don't mm-hmm. think that there's a thing that you can say that's going to make it better that she's now sleeping in a twin bed with someone next to someone who she didn't do life with because of where she is at this stage in her life.
That's good.
Chris?
Yeah, just to echo that, Amy, this is where really good hospice care is absolutely invaluable, mm-hmm. is that someone to a doula to journey to the end of life into the next life. Mm-hmm. Because to echo what you said, Jackie, to validate, yes, I would probably not want to wake up at 92 years old in the same situation also. And so, yes, I understand that. And is there something I could do for you right now? Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we can make this moment, this unbearable moment, a little more bearable? And so bringing a sense of comfort and care into this really, really tough situation where it's messy and hard and our own stuff gets in the way.
Depressing.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's so many people who are dealing with this subject. Thank you, Amy, for calling. We're going to send you a copy of 100 Days of Peace. And it is because there's more and more people aging and living longer and more caregivers. It's just part of this cycle. We'll be back after this.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have a question or a comment, call toll-free 1-800-229-3000. Now back to New Life Live.
Welcome back. We love to hear from you. And, you know, if this is part of the challenge that you're dealing with, give us a call, and we're going to find some support for Amy as she goes along. You know, I mentioned that we get calls different ways, and one of the other ways to send us a call is we get emails. And again, going to newlife.com/radio, and that's where the process, the way to submit those questions. But I wanted to provide a question for the wisdom of Jackie and Chris. And the background is, this is from Wendy. She's an in-home caregiver. How ironic that this question follows the one that we just answered. She works 4-hour shift once a week, and the wife of the 81-year-old client is making herself sick trying to take care of her husband. He neglected his health early in life and now has diabetes and is on dialysis, uses a walker and a wheelchair, and he likes to be waited on and resists doing things for himself. He believes God told him he would be healed. She's struggling with resentment because he doesn't work at trying to do things for himself, and she's exhausted. He's now insisting on using her inheritance money to have expensive dental work done so that when God heals him, he won't be ashamed of the way he looks when he shares his testimony. She may need that money to provide for her future needs after he passes, but she doesn't want to voice unbelief or lack of faith. How can I help someone in the Name It, Claim It movement when I believe they're being deceived? And a couple of her questions, you know, along with that is, when does practical and realistic become lack of faith and unbelief? And when does helping become enabling? That should keep you busy for a few minutes.
How many shows are we going to cover on this
Yeah,
one?
That might be three shows.
Oh, but
on that one.
So good. So rich here.
Yeah.
Really rich. Yeah. You know, because what this is a form of spiritual manipulation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, even when Jesus healed people, he asked something of them. There was something to be done. And healing was never a passive act, and it was never a wait and see. Mm-hmm. It was always do something, you know.
Pick up your bed and walk.
Exactly.
Go and sin no more.
Exactly. And so in the midst of all of this, this passivity is actually a form of unfaithfulness, not faithfulness.
Because faith without works is dead.
Yes, and because it's an avoidance. And that's this is when we talk about spiritualization as a defense mechanism. Spiritualization is an attempt to disconnect us from reality. But the faith of Jesus moves us directly into reality. And I think that that's a huge distinction that needs to be made here, because what he's also saying is that God is co-signing not only his suffering right now, God is co-signing her suffering. Mm-hmm. So when we're in these places that we're in this, well, I call it the victim state, you know, mm-hmm. and the victim state is that we're waiting for something external to fix our internals without willing to do anything about it whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that's just entitlement. That's just immaturity at the end of the day.
At 81, mm-hmm. They've been doing this probably for a long time.
This is not a new dance.
Yep. Not a new dance. And so Wendy coming in as a caregiver is coming in with a new set of eyes and seeing what has probably been going on for the entirety of their marriage mm-hmm. has been this woman catering to this person who isn't, he didn't do things to help himself stay healthy.
Yeah.
And now he's going to be passive about his recovery. Mm-hmm. And demanding of her, mm-hmm. Even to wanting her to pay for him to have dental work done at this point, at this stage, so that he can look good. That is such vanity.
Yeah.
That it just blows my
look
mind.
Look good when God heals him.
When God heals.
Yeah.
Just you being healed by God is going to be a good enough look.
Yeah.
But to continue to put upon her more and more weight feels abusive. And so my encouragement to Wendy would be to reach out to Adult Protective Services if she really does believe that this woman is being abused and she's not able to make decisions that are to her benefit because she has been caregiving for the entirety of her life. And so it doesn't even make sense to her to now stop that.
You know,
I love that.
In all of these, what we refer to as vulnerabilities, you know, is that he's not willing to do or hasn't been willing to do much about his own vulnerabilities and caretaking.
And hasn't had to.
Yeah.
Because he believes he's entitled to be taken care of, whether it is by his wife, a caregiver, or God healing him.
Mm-hmm.
He is entitled, and he is going to get it, and he has to do nothing.
Yeah.
I think
Steve used the term king baby.
Yes, for situations like this.
Yep.
I was thinking of his saying also that God is waiting for us to do what we can do. And it's, but I think, you know, the big highlight here for Wendy is the wife. The wife needs the support.
Yes.
She's got the resentment going, and whether he has a change of mind or not, we're talking about elderly who is not well. Mm-hmm. I mean, diabetes affects the way that we think and feel and, you know, the way we move about in the world. And so if Wendy, if you can help her get the support and help that she needs, this dynamic has been going on for a long time. And in order for her to make wise decisions from this point out, she's going to need that support.
I just got to say this. I can't get over the fact that, like, I'm on dialysis, but I want to get some dental work done.
Right.
Like, what?
Where are your priorities, sir?
But that keeps us in that state of disbelief, right, Chris?
Absolutely.
We hear that and we're like, you really think that?
Yeah.
Like, what do you, and then it keeps us from moving forward and detaching in a healthy way.
Yes.
So that the wife can be in a place of, I understand that that's what you're saying, but the reality is, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
We're not doing that. I'm glad you asked the question, Wendy. Hopefully that will settle.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Club New Life supporters who give a monthly donation because they want to continue to offer help and hope in these very, very difficult places. To find out more about Club New Life, you can go to our website, newlife.com, or call 1-800-NEW-LIFE. Now, if you're new to us, we drop an episode every weekday. We would love it if you would rate or write a review, which helps more people discover help and hope and helps us share wisdom with as many people as possible. Now, let's listen to our counselors as they help people walk through life's hardest places.
We're glad you joined us for New Life Live. To be a part of the program, call 1-800-229-3000. Now back to New Life Live.
Welcome back. I am so grateful for all of you who are supporting New Life Ministries. That means that you are making a difference in the lives of so many people. We have a matching gift campaign going on right now. And I want to encourage you, if you've never given to New Life up to this day, today's your day. You can give a dollar and it becomes two. You could give $100 and it becomes $200. And we just want to encourage you because we need to continue to help people in life's hardest places. That's what we've been doing for 35 years. We want to continue doing that. We thank you in advance for the gifts that you've given. If you want to make a gift, not if you want to get, when you make a gift, you're going to go to newlife.com/donate. You can text the word match to 28950, or you can call 1-800-NEW-LIFE and give your gift there. You can be sure that you're going to make a difference in someone's life, and it could be the very thing that they need. And in addition to that, if you make a gift of $100 or more, we are going to send the Every Woman's Bible, which Misty Erdeburn helped edit, on request. So just if you make a gift of $100 or more, you can ask for that Bible and we'll send it to you. And it's an incredible gift because God's Word changes our life and your gifts will change a life. So it's win-win all the way around. We're going to go to the calls and we're going to talk with Jennifer, who's calling us from Seattle, listens on YouTube. Thank you for watching on YouTube. Hit that subscribe and that like button. It makes the news go out about New Life and it helps more people. We're going to help Jennifer right now. How can we help you, Jennifer?
Hi. My sister-in-law died unexpectedly 3.5 weeks ago, and my brother-in-law is so distraught that I just want to know how my husband and I can help him.
Gosh, it's hard.
It's so hard.
Jennifer, were there children? Do they have children?
Yeah, but they're all older. They're all older kids. And we can't even talk to him because he is so sorrowful. He just cries the whole time. And I think he's stuck. Yeah. We don't know how to help him. He hasn't planned a service. It's just
how long were
really,
they married?
Really hard.
Jennifer, how
over
long were they married?
Years.
How many?
Over 30. Mm. Over 30.
Yeah.
I think really the best way you can help him is just being present. Even when you're on the phone with him and he's just hysterically crying, if he answered the phone, just be there with him while he's hysterically mm-hmm. crying. It's excruciatingly painful. And even for those adult children or those older children, it's incredibly painful to lose your partner, to lose your parent, and for it to happen unexpectedly. We had a similar situation in our family last year. My brother-in-law died of a heart attack unexpectedly, and he had teen and adult children. And the only thing we could do was get there, right? There's nothing else we could do to console. There's nothing you can say to make it better. It's just the presence of your mm-hmm. relationship and the connection, the just not being alone in the grief. And, you know, 2-3 weeks down the road is usually when people stop calling. Mm-hmm. I understand the services haven't happened yet. So in that realm, there may be some logistical things you guys can do to help. With my sister, when she lost her husband, and my nieces and nephews, we stepped in to help in whatever ways we could. With planning financially for the teens. We're picking up some of the slack that he might have picked up, or helping get the college kid from her internship site back to university. So there are some practical things that he's incapable of doing right now that you might offer support with.
Yeah,
Jennifer,
we can't
you said
talk to him about it.
What about his children? Have you talked to them? Are they able to talk to
him? We've tried to reach out to them, and we just haven't gotten. We just haven't heard back from them yet. We thought we would go through him first, and then try the kids.
Yeah, yeah. And when you have been with them, what has that been like? What's been the interactions?
You mean physically?
Yeah.
We haven't even seen them since it happened.
Okay, because he doesn't want you over, like.
Right. He's just really isolated, and we're concerned mostly because he has a depressive personality anyway.
Yeah.
So and he's now all alone.
Okay.
In his house.
So you may need to take things into your own hands and do what we would call a wellness check on him. You know, and so his deep grief, also his fear, a lot, you know, his depression, they're all hammering him. And so it's probably not him speaking. It's his condition that's speaking. And so let's ignore what the condition is trying to say and get to his real need. And this can I understand this can be really, really risky because you don't want to violate his wishes or inappropriately cross a boundary. But when you're talking about, like, he lost his wife, he's isolated, and he has he's prone to depression, this really can be life-threatening. And so that's where you may want to go over, and you and your husband together, I would highly encourage that, not alone, and just do a wellness check on him, you know?
Yeah, because sitting, it's almost like the tradition of sitting Shiva, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know in the Jewish tradition, that's, you know, you're just present. And I think presence matters in a time like this. It's so off-putting, though, when you experience someone else's grief or depression. It's overwhelming because of the sorrow and the pain. And we have to make sure that, okay, it's a lot, and this is not typical for him, and I need to step in closer.
Yeah.
And it can feel threatening to him, but you're not trying to hurt him. You're trying to help him. You're trying to carry him. And as far as the services go, eventually that will happen. But that, you know, a lot of times people will put that off. I was just talking about this with somebody earlier today that we have, since the pandemic, we've put off these natural rhythms that come with the loss of a loved one, you know? And so the burial rituals also can help us in our process of our grief. Jennifer, we're so sorry. I hope that's helpful. We'll send you a copy of Life Recovery workbook for grief. And I think that can give you some insight as well. But, you know, as you guys, we were just talking about this, the grief cycle, it's not just for a death. but it's literally for loss of any kind. Mm-hmm. And it does trigger other loss experiences. And when you're on the other side of that, it can be overwhelming to hold someone's pain and to sit well with them. But yet that's what we need to do.
And I would continue to reach out, whether it was just a text message or a call, to both him, your brother-in-law, and the nieces and nephews, because they need to know someone cares. Yes. Someone is thinking about this, and that this matters to someone. And that way, when they are at a place where they're ready to actually start to walk through their grief and process it, they have a safe place to go. They know that there was someone who was thinking about them throughout this. And 'cause often people want someone to share with them, but there's not the relationship there for that sharing to happen. So
that's good,
be mindful to maintain that relationship.
Do you know what's interesting, too, is that it just is always a challenge when we are experiencing the grief to ask for help. Mm-hmm. It's weird because we feel shame. We feel, you know, you hear people say, I'm so sorry that, you know, I'm crying.
Yeah, they feel like they have to take care of you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the whole grief journey, though, it affects all of us. I mean, so, Chris, you were talking about that on a previous show where we were talking about anger and the grief and how those two collide, especially in a sudden death, too.
Yeah, grief undealt with deals with us. Mm-hmm. You know, it will have its way. Yeah. And so when we suppress that, and I'm a suppressor, and what that does is leads us very vulnerable to the grief or the vulnerability of the sadness being transferred into the invulnerability of anger. And there's this really weird thing that happens. You know, it's kind of joke around, but it's not funny. Men don't get sad, they get angry. But what ends up happening is that the sadness is never truly dealt with and cared for the way it is. So we get stuck in cycles of anger. And underneath the anger is also a high vulnerability to medicators.
Yes.
Right? This is where it puts us at more vulnerability to addictive processes and substances because it works to anesthetize the difficult feelings. Yeah. And one of the things that I think is really important that is very difficult but very profound is that we're avoiding the need of grief. Mm. The need of grief is care, is comfort. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so somehow, despite Jesus himself asking his disciples to be with him, to care and comfort him, we think that we're beyond it. And we suffer and pay a heavy, heavy cost because we either don't care or we won't invite care into these deeper processes that we're experiencing.
The hard part is what Jennifer talked about, you know, if there's a history of depression, you know, grief affects us physically to the cellular core of our bodies, and it can trigger a depressive episode. But you know what? I love what you just said, Chris. Jesus was a man acquainted with grief, a man of sorrows. He knows that heartache, and we could trust him with that pain.
Yes.
We're going to be praying for this family, and we're going to be right back after this.
To find out more information about New Life or to order any of the resources mentioned on today's program, call 1-800-NEW-LIFE. Now back to New Life Live.
Welcome back. You know, we've been around for about 35 years. We have some incredible wisdom to share with you. We're going to go to a call from John and Henry talking to Brian.
Let's go to Brian from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Brian. Welcome to New Life.
Hey, guys.
How's it going? You sound kind of down here.
Yeah, it's really bad.
Okay, what's going on?
Is it possible that a wound can be so deep that you can never fully recover from it? That's the question.
Mm. What do you think, Henry?
What kind of wound are you talking about?
Well, I'll try to make it brief. I grew up, I'm 48 years old, and I grew up without my mother. I'd visit her every 6 weeks in the summer. But as a child, I grew up without her. My dad was pretty much emotionally unavailable. He was very rigid. My environment, I would describe as a toxic faith environment.
A lot of religion, not a lot of relationship.
Right. And so basically, I didn't get what I needed, and that led into relationship problems and eventually a sexual and relationship addiction. And the thing that happens every time I get into a relationship and it doesn't work out, the feelings that I had as a child when I would return home from visiting my mother resurface.
All of that abandonment and awful black hole isolation.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've listened to you guys for years. I have several of your books. I've been in therapy, you know, for 15 years. And this just still happens over and over and over again. And
what kind of therapy have you been in?
Some outpatient intensives, some, you know, mostly, you know, just individual counseling.
Individual. Tell me what that means. Have you had one therapist for 15 years?
No, I've had a few, but it's, yeah, just been an individual therapist.
Yeah. Have you ever been in a long-term intensive therapy? Now, what I mean by long-term is regular intensive therapy, long-term with a woman?
No.
Has that ever been recommended?
No.
What's the longest you've ever been with one counselor, and what's the frequency?
The longest with one, probably the current one that I'm going to, 5 years, but it's not. I'll go for maybe several months and then stop for a while and then go again.
Several months, what, weekly?
Weekly or bi-weekly, mostly bi-weekly.
You mean once every 2 weeks or twice a week?
Yeah, I'm sorry, every 2 weeks.
Let me tell you why I asked that, because what's really important. Now, obviously, I don't know you, and so you have to take all this with a grain of salt. But in you know, generally speaking, if somebody has a lot of disrupted what we call bonding, you know, early in life, have you ever read my book, Changes That Heal?
Very first book I read.
Okay, so you know that bonding section in there. Mm-hmm. Well, that stuff is so huge that it can really color, you know, relationships and well-being for, you know, a long time until it's healed. Now, what happens is a lot of times people will go into counseling and you do problem solving and counseling and, you know, kind of organize life and a bunch of stuff, which is very, very helpful. But the counseling that tends to get at the root of some of those kind of things is counseling that is really, really designed to, A, focus on the emptiness inside and the lack of attachment, and B, a counseling space that provides for that kind of attachment to actually occur. You follow me?
Okay.
And the kind of counseling that would do that, there's, you know, there's really three or four kinds, and I recommend all of them, you know, if somebody's had a history like yours. But one of them would be to get with a counselor who does depth attachment kind of work, but not on a twice a month. There's just no way you can do that twice a month. You know, well, I think it needs to be much more regular for that. You need to kind of, you know, sort of, you know, take your pack off and plan on being there a while. And B, a group that you stay with for a long time where that attachment to the group can be very, very powerful. And third, you know, a few friends that there are very deep attachments with of a non-romantic nature that go on for a long time as well. And the main thing about all of this stuff is it's really focused at your need instead of ignoring that need and then trying to get it met in these romantic and sexual ways that never will answer it. You follow me? And so to answer your question, this is not the kind of, as you call it, wound. It's not just a wound. It's really a sort of an uncompleted task and a deficit more than a wound, that it's in no way unhealable. We see this healed all the time. And I want to offer you, you know, as much encouragement as I can, that through significant healing attachments in multiple ways, you know, a therapist, a group, friends, all of that. And I don't mean light friendships. I mean deep friendships where you really talk about these pains and needs and you begin to experience a deep need for these people. Then it can be really powerfully healing.
Yeah, that's one problem. I don't really have those kind of friendships either.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me because, you know, you've been abandoned a lot in your life, right? So it's natural to not have those, not create those, you know, be afraid of them even. And so I, you know, I just wouldn't be surprised by that. So, but that doesn't mean you can't get them, you know, once you're aware of it. But I, you know, I see the city you live in. I know there's enormous resources there in the Christian community. Why don't we put you on hold and see if we can hook you up with someone?
All right. Now, let me ask you, how old did you say you were?
48.
Yeah.
48. Okay. Well, you got a lot of years left, and hopefully the
Brian, does that help?
Yeah, it does. But I think you understand that when a person is in a state that I'm in, it's they want a quick fix and they want something that, you know, 1, 2, 3, and boom, you're out of it. And I know the reality or the unreality of that.
Yeah, but let me give you some encouragement about that. And in fact, if you go back to Changes That Heal, I even said this, I think, in the bonding section where somebody comes in with a problem just like yours, and I said, here's what you need, and it's going to take a little while, but, you know, it's very powerful and can work. And they say, well, I was looking for something quicker than that. Can you refer to me somebody who does more short-term kind of work? And I said, yes, I can. I'll be glad to do that. But what happens is, and I'd seen this so many times, they come back, you know, 6 months, a year later, and they say, you were right. I did the short-term stuff. It helped on a few things, but it's not getting to this deeper thing. And as I said in the book, you know, sometimes a shortcut is the longest route because you don't get to the root. And the encouraging thing, Brian, is we're not talking about decades here. You know, if people begin to do the right kind of stuff that's not quick fix, I mean, how many affairs or how many sexual acting out episodes that are quick fixes have not worked? But see, all that time that's going by in those, in the sexual addiction that's not working, just a fraction of that time spent in kind of settling down somewhere gets enormous, enormous impact. And I believe, you know, if you go to the parable of the talents, for example, It's the multiplicative process. It's the one that buries the need in the ground, buries the talent and the ability to connect in the ground, that it stays the same over the years. But dig it up, bring it into the light, like I talked about in Changes That Heal, and it can multiply very quickly. It doesn't have to take 48 years.
Their wisdom continues to teach us today. We're so glad that you joined us today. Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Jack.
Thanks so much for listening. We hope something you heard will help you live in freedom today. If this content was helpful for you, we would love it if you'd take a minute, leave us a review, post about it, and rate it. Remember, we have resources and workshops online for you as you continue your journey. Go to newlife.com and find out more information. And thank you for being part of the New Life community. We know that God desires all of us to live a life of wholeness and healing. And we're so glad that you're here.